This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
So the release of the WPATH files, as far as I'm concerned, is the biggest medical scandal since lobotomies. It's as big as that. But what I've been quite surprised by is very few media outlets have been covering it because, of course, they have been pushing this ideology themselves and therefore are complicit. It doesn't sound real. It doesn't. It sounds like the stuff of fantasy. We've reached the point where we are putting children on a pathway to sterilization and castration, and we're doing that in the name of progress. And a lot of the cheerleaders are coming from the left. And no one saw that coming. Gay children are being fixed or heterosexualized on the NHS. There was a joke at the Tavistock Clinic among staff about how there's not going to be any gay people left. What the WPATH files reveal is that...
Hello, my heretics. That's what you are, and that's what this podcast is. And today, a heretic in the form of Andrew Doyle is on. I absolutely love Andrew Doyle. He was on the podcast in its former format, On the Edge with Andrew Gold, twice, and now we've done this lovely one in person. It looks absolutely, like, particularly gorgeous on the YouTube video version, so do go and check that out. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe Andrew was just looking particularly dapper, or we got the framing just right in this one, but it looks really, really good. And Andrew's, well, he's a presenter on GB News, but he also wrote The New Heretics and a sort of manifesto on free speech, which I would definitely recommend you get. And he has a new Substack, which means you can subscribe. You can subscribe to his page where he writes from the heart. And we talk about that and the comparison to sort of the binary aspect of Twitter, or X as it's now called, where you just put out a line and then, you know, or two lines, and then everyone shouts at you. Now, Andrew is one of my favorite people at GB News because he's not very far ideologically. I think left and right don't mean anything anymore, but most of his opinions really are very sensible, and I don't think he seems like, you know, too far gone at all. I think he's really on the money, so he's one of my favorite people to watch. He's really, really good, really intellectual. And at the end, we talk about the fact that, look, we love talking about the culture wars and all these things, but sometimes you want to talk about art and literature and humanities and things like that. Andrew was formerly a teacher of literature, so he knows his stuff. And I've had many off-camera discussions with him about all that stuff that we cherish and hold dear, but no, do not get the same number of clicks and things as these kinds of discussions, which are also very important to us. Anyway, I've rambled for 2 minutes about Andrew and gushed about him, but this is a really important episode because this is about the WPATH scandal. Now, WPATH, who even knows what that stands for? He tells me in the episodes, you'll hear him say it. Maybe I can look it up. The World Professional Association for Transgender Health. Little bit like the Twitter files, which was a few years ago, Michael Schellenberger released this big bunch of files that showed that Twitter was politically involved in a leftist manner and was banning people who were further on the right and were getting told by politicians what they should and shouldn't do, and all these kinds of things. And they were shadow banning people. They were basically banning people and making their accounts do worse if they held the wrong political opinion, something that Twitter always denied doing. So that was a big scandal a few years ago. This time, with the help of, well, with the research of Maya Hughes and Jen Specht, Stella O'Malley, Michael Schellenberger again released this whole WPATH thing. This time it's like a Twitter files, but for the whole transgender thing. And it basically shows all these doctors talking about stuff. They know that the kids had no idea what they were getting into. They know the kids don't even know basic biology, and yet they were changing them forever. I just saw a video before of a lady saying that she would definitely want her kids to get a change, to change their gender, which I don't believe you can do, but not a tattoo, because a tattoo is permanent. That shows the utter ignorance, I think, of people, because this is all pretty permanent, unfortunately. But, you know, if it helps some people, that's what makes this all so complicated, doesn't it? You know, but not kids. Anyway, puberty blockers have just been banned since I spoke to Andrew, banned by the NHS, which is the National Health Service in England. So this is what's happening. That's what the story is about today. That's what Andrew's going to mostly be talking about, as well as the latent homophobia in this whole system. It's really, really interesting. Hope you enjoy it. Please do subscribe to Andrew's Substack or get his books, The New Puritans and Free Speech. I'll put links to all of that in the description. And enjoy this episode of Heretics. What is WPATH?
WPATH is the World Professional Association of Transgender Health. And this is a body that was set up in America in 1979. And it is the leading global authority on what they call gender medicine, which is actually a very experimental form of treatment. But they influence all sorts of medical bodies across the Western world, across the Anglosphere, even the NHS. The NHS has been explicitly informed by WPATH. The Tavistock Clinic, as we know, the famous gender pediatric clinic in London, which closed since the interim CAS review found that it was unsafe for children. It hasn't yet closed because they're pretty tenacious, but it will close at some point. In other words, WPATH is kind of, I suppose, the body of the Hydra of gender identity ideology that spreads all over the globe. That's what WPATH is. I presume you're asking that because of the recent revelations of the WPATH files.
That's right. Released, and we should say, because there's a lot of debate over who released what, is Michael Schellenberger and Maya Hughes and Jen Specht and Stella O'Malley were involved.
I can explain. I wasn't involved at all, but I have spoken to all the people who were. So good. Michael Schellenberger, as you know, was involved in the Twitter files, as it was certainly in reporting on the Twitter files. And since then, a lot of sort of whistleblowers have come to him about various things. So a whistleblower or a number of whistleblowers from within WPATH came to him and said, look, we've got this information. We'd like to leak it to you. That information comprised of various internal messaging board stuff from the internal chat system of WPATH, where you have various clinicians discussing their treatment practices. And they also had lots of video footage of the various sort of Zoom meetings that they had. All of this got leaked to Michael Schellenberger, and he has a think tank called Environmental Progress. And one of the members of staff at that think tank is Mia Hughes, who's a journalist. And she did a lot of most of the work, because she wrote the full report on the WPATH files. And that has now been released. And Jen Specht and Sex Matters are two groups who have worked to, publicize and release it over here in the UK. So they have been involved in that respect. So all of these various people, and they've done a really diligent job insofar as they didn't want to release the information until there was a full report to accompany it, and there was explanatory notes. There were links to sort of medical journals and all that kind of thing.
What's some of the most egregious stuff that's been revealed?
Right. So the main findings of the WPATH files are that when it comes to gender medicine, okay, we're often dealing with children who suffer from what they call gender dysphoria, what they used to call gender identity disorder. And you're dealing with vulnerable adults. You're dealing with a predominance of young gay individuals or same-sex attracted individuals and autistic individuals. So in those circumstances, when someone is struggling with their gender, they will go to a pediatric gender clinic. And often, because of the influence of the likes of WPATH, they will be put on puberty blockers so that they have some time to pause and think. And that, in almost all cases, leads to cross-sex hormones, and in some cases thereafter to irreversible surgery. What the WPATH files reveal is that, firstly, that a lot of the people involved in this, a lot of clinicians, a lot of medical experts in this field, know full well that a lot of the patients cannot give informed consent to these procedures.
Wow.
What it means, it's pretty explosive stuff, actually, and I should emphasize, these people are not speaking in the capacity of spokespeople for WPATH. So whatever findings are within the report that Mia Hughes wrote, which, by the way, people are free to disagree with the interpretation of those leaked messages, but the messages themselves are authentic. They're not speaking on capacity of WPATH, they're speaking for themselves. But what it does mean is that a lot of members of WPATH who are leading clinicians who perform this kind of surgery on a regular basis do know that a lot of their patients cannot really consent to this. Some of the lines are quite incredible. There's one doctor saying, you know, they haven't even studied high school biology and we're putting them on this. Phrases like that. Someone else says, you speak to them and you suddenly realize they don't really understand what you're saying. There's one person who talks about someone with schizophrenia or dissociative identity disorder, and they end up going on this pathway to surgery. Mm. Now, how can someone like that consent? How can a prepubescent child even conceptualize the idea of lifelong sterility, the idea of a lack of sexual function? They can't. And we always knew that. Like, everyone always knew that this was the case. But the new thing is that now we know the people practicing these procedures know it themselves. That's significant. They are also fully aware that a lot of people end up regretting. They're fully aware of the existence of detransitioners. They treat it in the files as kind of trivial. They say, oh, well, it's just kind of inevitable. They are aware that a lot of these kids are same-sex attracted. I mean, if you take the Tavistock, we know from Hannah Barnes's book on the Tavistock Clinic, which is called Time to Think, that between 80 and 90% of adolescents who were referred for gender treatment at the Tavistock were same-sex attracted. So what that's practically all of them. In other words, what you have is a situation where gay children or children who are likely to grow up gay are being fixed or heterosexualized on the NHS because it could be all sorts of reasons. It can be internalized homophobia. It can be homophobia within the family. Whistleblowers from the Tavistock have made clear that there was endemic homophobia there, not just from staff, but from parents who didn't like the idea of having a gay kid.
Wow.
There was a joke at the Tavistock clinic among staff about how, oh, there's not going to be any gay people left, which means they knew full well what they were doing. But effectively what we've got at the moment, or what we have had, is gay conversion therapy being practiced by the NHS in plain sight. And no one saw that coming. Right now, and a lot of the influence that has led to this sort of ideological shift from the idea that these people who are suffering from these symptoms are suffering from a psychiatric problem, in other words, a gender identity disorder, the shift in language from that to gender dysphoria and the idea that it's not actually a psychiatric problem, it's something that should be treated with medicine, it should be medicalized, that is an ideological shift. That's what's happened here. And that's why this is really important, because effectively we've reached the point where we are putting children on a pathway to sterilization and castration in some cases. And we're doing that in the name of progress. And a lot of the cheerleaders are coming from the left, and no one saw that coming.
Yeah. The homophobia thing. I mean, you say no one saw it coming, but obviously, I mean, you did, because you've been speaking about it for years. Many of us did. That kind of homophobia aspect, I think in Pakistan, India, that's been happening.
Oh, yeah.
People can't be gay, so they have to pretend they're a woman.
Well, not just that. The Iranian government funds sex change operations for homosexuals, because otherwise they'll hang you from a crane. And I just think it's quite astonishing that the NHS physicians in the UK would have that in common with the mullahs of Tehran. I think that's a bizarre thing. And certainly Pakistan, the Pakistani government also a few years ago introduced financial support for people who, homosexuals, who wanted to change sex. And at the time, the Pink News put out a short video saying, this is amazing. Pakistan has just said yes to trans rights. And they waved a little flag. Now, the idea that Pink News, which is supposedly a gay rights publication, would be cheering on the surgical erasure of gay people, that is amazing, isn't it? I still can't really get my head around it. And of course, a lot of it is based on just not understanding the situation. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a debate in Parliament recently where a Conservative MP, Alicia Kearns, was effectively standing up and calling for gay conversion therapy in the guise of a ban on trans conversion therapy. But yes. What they mean by trans conversion therapy is a psychotherapeutic approach to the problem of gender identity disorder. In other words, if a physician talks to a child and says, look, there might be other factors that we have to explore here. Have you been abused? Are you same-sex attracted? Are you suffering from internalized homophobia? Are you autistic? Let's not forget that roughly, you know, 35% of children in the country are on the autistic spectrum. And 2% of children, and 35% of referrals to the Tavistock were on that same spectrum. That shouldn't be happening. That kind of difference is too egregious for there not to be some reason behind it. But what the likes of Alicia Kearns and Lloyd Russell Moyle, the Labour MP, by the way, this isn't a left-right issue, this is coming from both sides, What they're effectively saying in Parliament is that we want to support the idea of effectively criminalizing clinicians who want to do some kind of explorative therapy and therefore fast track gay kids onto that pathway of sterilization. So they are supporting gay conversion therapy. But I must add, without knowing that they are supporting gay conversion therapy, I've been really shocked when I hear the speeches of people like that. They just don't understand the issues. They just don't know what they're talking about. Hmm. And yet they are promoting this very dangerous, anti-gay, homophobic ideology through the statute books if they got their way. Keir Starmer has already committed to it. And I think that a lot of gay people, a lot of gay activists from yesteryear who are now coming out of retirement and thinking, we've got to fight these battles all over again. You know, back in the 60s, you had state-sanctioned electroshock therapy, state-sanctioned brain surgery for gay men. I was once in an LGBT coming out play, which was a verbatim show where we read actual stories of coming out stories from lesbian, gay, bisexual and trans people. And one of the stories that I was involved with was a man from Liverpool who in the 60s was sent to a conversion clinic on the NHS effectively. And it was a clinic, they made him look at gay pornography while they ingested some kind of chemical to make him vomit.
Oh my God.
They forced him to drink Guinness to make him vomit.
It's Clockwork Orange.
Yeah. It's exactly Clockwork Orange, aversion therapy. And that was just state sanctioned. You know, there was a doctor in America called Gal Braith who performed brain surgery and wrote a paper that was published in which he claimed that he could cure homosexuality through this procedure. Now, that's the gay conversion therapy of yesteryear, although it's still going on insofar as we have religious fundamentalists who have gay camps where you can pray the gay away, which I do think at least is a step further forward than a surgery. But it's not good either. You have corrective rape. It's still going on in a number of countries, a particular problem in certain countries in Africa where lesbians are correctively raped order to heterosexualize them. There was a very good report on this in the New York Times a few years ago. Not very good, very traumatic to read, but you know what I mean? It's important that we know about this stuff. So, you know, when we think of the phrase conversion therapy, we think of all that sort of stuff, right? We think of brain surgery, castration, corrective rape. But what we don't think of is the Tavistock Clinic taking on board predominantly gay kids and heterosexualizing them through puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and eventually surgery. This is just the new manifestation of that. So the release of the WPATH files, as far as I'm concerned, is the biggest medical scandal since lobotomies. It's as big as that. But what I've been quite surprised by is very few media outlets have been covering it because, of course, they have been pushing this ideology themselves and therefore are complicit and have been doing it for so long. I mean, what is it now? It's 5 days after the news broke that when we're recording this, not one article on the BBC News website about this. You know, they've got articles about like cats stuck in trees and all sorts of stuff, but they haven't covered this. Some have. The Telegraph have an article. The Daily Mail have an article. Janice Turner wrote a piece for The Times. There's been bits here and there. It should be the front page of every newspaper for more than a day. It's that huge. So I've been pretty shocked about that. It's all woken me up to the willful negligence, because at this point, that's not that's omission deliberately, isn't it? You cannot not know about this. Everyone's talking about it, but they've decided not to cover it. And that, to me, I think is more sinister than if they had covered it in a critical way. I mean, as Schellenberger and Mia Hughes have said, people should feel free to criticize their interpretation of what is said in the WPATH files and what the report says. But to pretend it doesn't exist, it's almost like you're just saying gay people don't count. And not just gay people. Anyway, people who are suffering from these psychiatric problems who need help. You know, the WPATH file, can I give you a bit of context with this? The WPATH has a thing called Standards of Care. And this is a document that informs all sorts of medical practices. It's why when you go to the General Medical Council's website, there's a link to WPATH. You can do that today and it's right there. It's why in Sandyford Clinic in Glasgow, there was a leaked recording to the Daily Telegraph last year showing that a clinician there is informed by WPATH regulations, even though the NHS now denies that. But it's clearly informing everything. There are documents from 2013 at the Tavistock that says explicitly, our policies are informed by WPATH. They're informed by standards of care. Now, these WPATH standards of care, which are available online, they're on version 8 at the moment. Now, when the draft of version 8 came out, the NHS in Scotland uploaded it on their website. There's a section in that standards of care that talks about eunuch identity. And it's talking about how the idea of being a eunuch is a legitimate gender identity. It should not be pathologized. And it's urging medical practitioners to engage in the castration of patients who ask for it if they have this eunuch fetish, which is what I would say it is. And they even link in the WPATH Standards of Care to a eunuch fetish site called the Eunuch Archives, which has a connected site called the Fiction Archives, where there is explicit pornographic writings relating to child castration and child sexual abuse. Now, all of this was uncovered by a woman called Genevieve Gluck for a website called Redux back in 2022. She's done amazing research, amazing work. No one touched it. There was, however, a report in The Telegraph talking about this. And the only reason it got really reported is because NHS Scotland had uncritically uploaded this draft, which was effectively directing patients to child castration porn, which is not something the NHS should be doing. And after that, the NHS did apologize. They did withdraw, saying we're distancing ourselves from WPATH. So all of that happened. No one really talked about it. The current WPATH standards of care, which is the official version of that I'm talking about, the draft version, the current version does still retain the chapter on eunuch as a gender identity. It's all there, number of pages, 4 or 5 pages, with suggestions to medical practitioners about, you know, why it's important that you validate the identity of eunuchs by removing their testes if they demand it. Now, if I were to go to the doctor and say, I want my feet removed, you know, I mean, I'm a liberal. I believe you should be able to do whatever you want to your own body and live however you want. But I don't believe a doctor should just do it if I ask for it. You know, I don't think that's ethical. Yeah. I think it's against the Hippocratic Oath, the first do no harm principle.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So all of this is verifiable for people who want to look at it because it sounds made up. I think one of the reasons why Genevieve Gluck at Redux had such a frustrating time of it that people weren't picking up on it is because it doesn't sound real. It doesn't. It sounds like the stuff of fantasy. How can it be that the world's leading healthcare professionals in the area of trans medicine are endorsing the idea of eunuch as a gender identity and moreover linking to a fetish site? And that could be then republicized by the National Health Service in the UK. It sounds not true, frankly. Why the WPATH files are so important is that they are now bringing all of this stuff into the mainstream. It's bringing it to the attention. Hopefully, even though the mainstream media are doing their utmost to ignore it, it's hopefully getting it out there more and more, which is why I get very frustrated when I see all these online debates among feminists where they're saying, some people are saying things like, oh, we've known about this all along. What's the point of the WPATH files? It doesn't matter. It's like, it matters if you care about the castration of children over your ego. It matters. I mean, I understand why people are frustrated that they've been talking about this for years and no one's done anything. That I get. But the idea that we shouldn't all be just publicizing the hell out of the WPATH files for the sake of the people who are going to be the victims of this. I don't understand that.
Feels a bit like the Coldplay effect. You know, I knew Coldplay before, so I don't need to say that the first albums were good.
Yeah.
Do you think we have an issue then, maybe with intent, right? So the gay conversion you spoke of before, clearly the intent, although they would have thought they were doing it in the name of good, was quite evil by our standards today.
Yes.
The intent today is, oh, we're helping have even more freedom of sexuality. And that's what they seem to think. And so aside from being complicit, that's part of why this is being covered up. They feel complicit. We've gone this far. We've got to go further.
Yeah.
Is it also that? Like people are going, oh God, but they're trying to help, I think. That's what they think.
Yeah, but that's the age old problem, isn't it? I mean, I'm sure the Taliban and ISIS think that they're doing God's work.
Yeah.
Like I don't think anyone or any ideological movement really thinks that they're doing things for the sake of evil.
Even Hitler probably.
No, I'm sure. I know. We know that he thought he was doing the right thing. But it doesn't make it good. You know, I mean, this is the problem. And, you know, I would balk at that insofar as I am not comparing these people to Hitler. I should emphasize that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But what I am saying is that, yes, I think you're right. It is evil what is happening. But it is being performed by people who think they're doing good. Absolutely no doubt about that. You know, some of these clinicians quite clearly and sincerely believe that the only way to resolve child gender dysphoria is puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones and medicalization. And, you know, for a long time now, we've heard this from activists, from medical practitioners, unless you trans your child will commit suicide. That is the thing that we always hear, which is a horrible thing to say to a parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the worst thing that a parent can hear. Of course, people are going to go along with this. You know, they say, would you rather have a trans child or a dead child? Now, the problem with that is that's been debunked. We know that's no longer the case, right? So we know that, you know, I mean, last year we had a letter to the Wall Street Journal from 21 leading specialists in gender care for gender diverse youth. And they all said, the fact is there is no evidence that puberty blockers are connected to a reduction in suicidal ideation. It's just not there. And then the key thing, I think, was last month, which was when there's a study published in the British Medical Journal. And this is a group of Finnish adolescents who have been monitored between 1996 and 2019. And these are Finnish adolescents who are suffering from gender dysphoria and being treated for gender dysphoria. And it turns out there is absolutely no correlation between this treatment and a reduction in suicidal ideation. So we know, in fact, after the procedures, often suicidal ideation increases. So we know now for a fact that lie, that unless you medicalize your child, they will kill themselves. So that's firstly not true. And it's important that people know that is not true. What we have to get back to, I think, and I'm not a medical expert, but from what I've read and from the experts that I've listened to, I've listened to experts on all sides of this, my feeling is that we at least have to have a debate about the idea of changing our approach to children who are suffering from these conditions to more a psychotherapeutic route, a psychiatric route, rather than to medicalize them. That would be my view. And also to maybe uphold the principle of not attempting to stigmatize and therefore medicalize gender non-conforming youth. It is okay for a boy like me. When I was a boy, I had interests more in line with what girls enjoyed. I didn't like football. I had to pretend to support a particular team to avoid getting beaten up. I just chose Yeovil Town at random, you know, which apparently made things worse because they weren't a very good team.
That will do, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I learned that later. But the point is, if you're a gender non-conforming youth, it should be okay. You shouldn't be encouraging a young child, a young boy, saying that, you know, if you're effeminate, if you've got gay instincts, if you don't like football, if you like wearing dresses, you're therefore a girl in the wrong body. Mm-hmm. And at the heart of all of this is this faith-based system, this ideology that, you know, we have such a thing as a kind of gendered soul, as Helen Joyce puts it in her book, and that it's a misalignment between soul and body. That's just a rehabilitated form of homophobia. That's all that is. You know, the bullies at school, when I was at school, if you were effeminate, they'd say, you're just a girl, you're not a real boy. And now it's the medical practitioners saying that.
Isn't it amazing, this sort of cycle and the way the pendulum swings each way, and now it's the medical people who would say they're on the left or something. And then,
well, it always comes back. This is the thing. I think homophobia finds a way. I think there is something about it that it's always existed, and it's just taken various forms. You know, back in the Middle Ages, they would burn homosexuals to death. You know, back when I was growing up, there was just general stigmatization, and you would see in newspapers like The Sun and The Express, and in fact, all of them, they would talk about pufters and Nancy boys and how they were dangerous for children and all this kind of stuff. And nowadays, it's just this. You know, we had a kind of sweet spot in about the 2000s, up into about 2010, where no one cared. No one cared, right? I mean, the last time I experienced overt homophobia, and I experienced quite a lot when I was sort of in between the years 18 to 24, but no after that, I didn't have it, you know? I mean, I remember being in a restaurant holding my boyfriend's hand and people making a show of moving away in disgust.
Mm. And his body was attached to the hand, was it?
That's right, yes.
Right, exactly. Otherwise, because that would have, why there would have been disgust if you just
they were disgusted
cut
about
his
it.
Hand off or something.
No, I didn't. I don't resort to that kind of behavior.
Mm. Not anymore.
So they moved. Yeah, that kind of thing wouldn't happen. There was a period where that just wouldn't happen. No one sort of...
But they wouldn't look at you now, would they? If you're holding your boyfriend's hand or you're in the wrong body. Is that...
Well, I mean, there are certain places where that would happen. No, but what I'm saying is that at the time, the reason those sorts of things were happening is because there was just a general acceptance that it was okay to be overtly homophobic, to be because people were doing it on TV. You know, mainstream commentators were doing it. So, I mean, why shouldn't they? You know, when I was at school, the teachers were doing, you know, so why shouldn't you? What's changed now is that all of that stuff is being sort of validated by the establishment just in different ways. And it is different. It's not identical. So you're right to raise that point. Mm. But it's just another kind of way in which that ancient prejudice finds an outlet. It's almost as though you can never vanquish it. I don't think you can. I think because by nature, predominantly as a human species, we are heterosexual. The vast majority of us will be heterosexual. And there is something about people who don't share your sexual proclivities that there is a tendency towards disgust as a reaction among human beings. I think ultimately, we are never going to vanquish homophobia. The best that we can do, I think, in a liberal society is encourage a kind of social contract by which we don't stigmatize people who are gay. And ultimately, we'll end up in a point where we were, I think, where we were around, I'd say 2007, was the perfect moment to be gay in the UK.
Yeah.
And then it all went downhill.
It was a good time. I would have been 18 about that time. But even then, a few years before that, I wonder if that disgust you talk about, we can go into what disgust is and where it comes from and everything, is a concern that we might be gay. I was worried that I would be gay. And I choose my words correctly. I mean, I was worried that I might be gay because of what that might mean for me. What, you know, and that was in a time where, as you say, we were doing all right for homophobia.
Yeah, but as I say, it never really goes away. When I say a sweet spot, I mean, it's the best it's ever likely to get.
Yeah.
I think that's what I mean. I think everyone worries about being, particularly when you're a kid, particularly when you're an adolescent, you know, that's that period, that's odd period in life where you want to be a rebel and also desperate to be a conformist at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think when you're a gay adolescent and you're realizing that, you think, okay, that's not good because I'm going to be different. I'm going to be in a minority. And, you know, I felt that way as well. In fact, I would go so far as to say I thought, because I never found women attractive ever.
Mm.
I was only attracted to men. And I kind of, looking back on it, I think I assumed that everyone kind of secretly felt the same way.
I think there's some of it though. I definitely, as a boy, being confused and not what's going on,
right.
I would be, oh, well, I do love my mate Jack or whatever. And, you know, I've purposely chosen I didn't have a friend called Jack, but Jack, oh yeah, well, do I really love, do, you know?
Yeah.
Because you're confused at that age, it's all a bit, and then you sort of go one way maybe. I don't know how it works.
I don't know how it works either. All I know is that when it comes to, how can I put this without being crude? Well, what do people masturbate over? what do you think about when you have a wank?
Yeah.
Ultimately,
Jack. I mean, no, I don't know.
Well, but ultimately, it doesn't lie at that point.
Yeah.
Ultimately, at that point, you're not lying to yourself anymore, are you? And
that's right.
I think those kind of feelings of deep emotional connection with someone, which everyone feels for both sexes, I believe, there's a line, isn't there, between that and the sort of the sexual impulse.
Yeah.
Sorry to be crude. I don't want to be vulgar.
I think it's a really good point, though.
I couldn't think of any other way to really explain it.
Well, it's a really important point. And that, you know, I don't want to show off about my new book, Psychology of Secrets, but I did a whole survey on what people do at home. Because I think that is one of the most important things today affecting us is shame from the discrepancy between the social media. I know that's been said, but the social media portrayal of what everyone's up to and what everyone's doing and the person at home who picks their nose a lot.
Right.
So we can
I'm glad that I was able to facilitate a segue into your book.
I know. Should we just talk about my book for the
and
next
actually,
half an hour?
You didn't even ask me to do that. I think people will think, they will assume that you asked me and absolutely you didn't.
No, I know. I don't usually get to talk about my own book. This is great. Let's not talk about yours at all today. When I ask you later to talk about your work, just talk about mine, please.
I will.
What I was interested in was how often people massive. And then people started, you know, friends of mine were going, you just want to know what everyone's up to. This isn't for a book at all. But it was for a book.
Yes.
And I focus a lot on nose picking as well, because I think, of course, masturbation we talk about a lot. That's like the one. But nose picking, I got a friend's story in the book about he was like 10 years old and he was picking, having a real good pick in the car. And then he looked to the right and he realized, because they were in traffic, there were like three or four girls about his age who were looking at him and laughing and pointing. And that stayed with him forever.
Oh, really?
I thought, how sad, because from my survey, everyone's doing it all the time, like frequently. People are worried. They're like burning a hole in their nose. But no one wants to talk about this. And it's not an attractive sell for a book, really, actually. So I'll go off the nose picking.
It's not just about that, is it?
There's about, no, there's 9 chapters about nose picking and 1 about masturbation. Psychology of Secrets.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's not. It's not. It's always weird stuff. I'll tell you about it later.
Okay.
But, okay, so a lot of people were going on this whole WPATH thing. A lot of people will say, oh, this is all fringe. This is not that important, blah, blah, blah. But then I'm also seeing that Labour, who are the opposition party in the UK for those outside of Britain, who might get in.
They will get in.
Will get in.
Yeah.
Okay. It's just, well, we always get told that, don't we?
I'm not a prophet, but I'm pretty sure on that one. I'd love to go on the record. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Because I want to get something right. I know. I got Brexit wrong. I got Trump wrong. I want to get this one right.
Okay. Okay.
Although this is an easy bet.
It looks like they're getting in. Yeah. And they are also promising, I keep seeing all sorts of quite extreme things with regards to trans. Have you been across that?
Yeah. Well, Keir Starmer is committed to it, to trans conversion therapy ban. He's committed to the implementation of more stringent hate speech laws regarding the protected characteristics of being gay and being trans. Although being trans identified isn't a protected characteristic in the Equality Act. Gender reassignment is a protected quality. Of course, a lot of people won't know that because Stonewall misrepresents the law and has been caught misrepresenting the law in their various training sessions to suggest that being trans in of itself. It's the reason why India Willoughby recently thought that he could report J.K. Rowling to the police for referring to him as a man, which was factually wrong. So
India, I mean, because India is that's a man. I mean, you use the male pronouns there. Is that something? I mean, that's something we all have to decide, isn't it? Are we going to use, which pronouns do we use?
I recently got piled on by a group of gender critical feminists. I have to say, a minority of gender critical feminists fall into this category because I mentioned that in the past when I've spoken about close friends of mine, trans identified close friends of mine, I have used the pronouns that they prefer. I never do it in my reporting. I get really angry when I see the BBC referring to a sex offender or a murderer as she, when it's clearly a man. I think that's just misleading the public. Mm. So I never do anything like that. But I think the way that I choose to use my language in private about people I know who are not gender ideologues is frankly no one else's business. And I got a lot of people criticizing me, which I welcome. And I think I'm open to persuasion on this, right? Their argument is that it's a slippery slope. If you use it once or twice for a close friend, then that's a slippery slope to, men in women's prisons. I'm not convinced of that argument yet, and no one's convinced me of it yet. But I'm open to it, and I'd like to have that discussion. So even when there were hundreds of people criticizing me online, because it was a bit of a pile-on, I was trending for 2 days.
You left Twitter.
Twitter after it. I said, I'm totally, I don't mind that, right? It was the abuse. There were hundreds and hundreds of people sending abuse, lying about me, saying that I was a grifter, saying that I was a misogynist, saying that I wanted to hurt children, all sorts of incredible, just morally repugnant behavior. But I think it's only a minority. It's a small cluster of authoritarians within the feminist movement who basically cannot countenance the very concept of someone disagreeing with their point of view.
Yeah.
And what they will do rather than criticize is attempt to destroy your reputation. In other words, they are the same as the TRAs who engage in cancel culture. They're the same thing.
Which means this is a very human thing to do, to gather that's the New Puritans, that's your book, isn't it?
Exactly. You see it in all political and ideological spheres. It is not specific to one side of the political aisle or the other.
Purity spiral.
It's a human thing, exactly. So there's a tendency towards moral purity. And, I recently posted a thing on my Substack about the importance of critical thinking. Mm. And then I saw someone today complaining online saying, oh, well, Andrew Doyle didn't exercise much critical thinking when it came to the vaccines. And of course, what that person's doing is they're mistaking the idea of critical thinking for you should agree with everything I say. Okay, that's not what it is. So there is an expectation of moral purity within every single group, and critical thinkers avoid that. Mm. And also, if it is the case that you're only interested in what I write and what I say, so long as I agree with everything that you agree with, then frankly, I'd rather you didn't bother with me. I'm not interested in that.
Yeah.
And I think we need to be able to not only be able to talk to people who disagree, but to maintain friendships with people who disagree. That seemed to me to be a major problem of today. Now, I should say that the vast majority of gender critical feminists don't fall into this category, and they're perfectly willing to have rational debates about these very important issues without resorting to abuse. But I'm afraid there were hundreds who did resort to abuse and libel, frankly, and I'm just not interested in that. By the time, it had gone on for hours, and by the time I got into the night when there were some actual overt homophobic things coming my way, and I thought, hang on a minute, this is a bit dodgy. And then I started getting contacted by all these gay activists saying, yeah, we've had the same thing, and sending me evidence of feminists sending the most gruesome homophobic stuff. And I was just seeing all this stuff, hundreds, and bear in mind, in the middle of a Twitter pylon, it's intense. And there's hundreds of these at once. And I start, and by the point where there was an activist saying that she wanted to murder gay people, I just thought, I'm switching off now. And I turned the whole thing off, and I moved away from it. And it's partly my own fault, because I should be able to turn the whole thing off as soon as that thing happens. But I am fascinated by it.
Of course.
And I see, because there are all these people saying things about me, a total stranger, that it would never occur to me to do that. It would never cross my mind to see something I disagree with, even passionately, and send abuse or lie about that person. It would never cross my mind to do it. And so I'm fascinated by people who do. And it turns out there's a lot of people who do. And so I watch it like some sort of grotesque car wreck that I can't take my eyes away from. And it drags me down and down and down. So what I realized was, the problem is Twitter. Twitter as a forum, or X, if you want to call it that, lends itself towards that kind of mob behavior, herd mentality. Suddenly people are behaving not as independent thinkers, but as part of like the Borg or something. Mm-hmm. And so I just sort of thought, you know what? It's not possible to have rational conversations on Twitter. So I removed myself from it and I set up a Substack. And my logic was, I can write pieces that are more long form. I can open up the comments to paid subscribers and give quite a low fee, which means that those who are serious about having a conversation will pay the low fee and they'll come in. I don't think people who want to just send me abuse are going to pay me for it, for the privilege. I mean, maybe they will, but they haven't done it yet. And it's worked really, really well. I've really enjoyed it because I've had some serious conversations on Substack. I've been challenged in my position. I've rethought various things and no one has called me a faggot yet. So this to me is kind of a good step forward. And I've decided not to get involved with conversations on Twitter. And I've only used Twitter to post references to my Substack, with the exception of this week, because the WPATH files were exposed. And I think it's too important for me to worry about my rules about how I use Twitter. It's too important to get this out there. So I will keep tweeting about WPATH. Then I'll delete all those tweets when this is over. But yeah, I was just posting about my Substack. The frustrating thing is, because Elon Musk has had a fallout with Substack, you can't mention the word Substack or provide a link to a Substack article. So you have to do this weird thing where you say, the link to my website is in my bio. I'm not going to say what the website is, but just click on the link. So it's really weird. But Substack, for me, is a better fit. If you like all the rough and tumble of Twitter and you like the salt and you like wrestling with the pigs, then that's absolutely fine. By the way, I'm not using dehumanizing language there. I'm actually borrowing from a phrase that was attributed to Mark Twain. No.
Rolling a shit with pig?
Not quite.
One of you will like it. Sorry.
It's actually never wrestle with a pig, because you get dirty and the pig enjoys it.
Yes.
And of course, all phrases of that kind end up being attributed to Mark Twain, whether he said it or not.
Yes.
I don't think he did, but
that was also Mark Twain. All phrases that are attributed to Mark Twain.
Probably.
So I've had some of it myself. And it is really upsetting. And I think people listening might go, oh, but why didn't you just ignore them? I've tried that sort of bravado thing. And you get yourself into a bravado mode. Yeah. And I'm saying to others, oh, you know what? I just don't care what people say at all. But then you see someone, it's like, you think you've moved into this group, and then that group then disowns you. That's one of the worst things that can happen. I mean, in the tribe, you were thrown out in the savannah.
I think it is worse, for instance, for people who are in that gender critical tribe, to have people turn on them. I'm not in that tribe. Yeah, I don't have a tribe. I don't have an ideology. I'm not part of a movement. I've always just said what I think to be true at any given time. It just so happens that a lot of the things that I'm passionate about at the moment happen to align with a lot of people within that movement. And that's why I've developed a lot of good friendships with people within that movement. But I would hope that those friendships aren't contingent on complete agreement at all times. And I don't think they are.
I had someone the other day, and it was a tweet saying, oh, look, another man talking about women's issues and all this kind of thing. Now, you can probably guess, but that was a man who tweeted that.
Yeah, of course.
And it's like speaking on behalf. And then I tried, but that's when because usually I go, I'm just going to be a wall. I'm not going to reply. But obviously I have to reply to that. And I replied to that thinking, right, I've just won Twitter, but obviously that's not how it works. And suddenly there's hundreds of people defending that person.
Going,
that person's been there from the beginning. Where were you? To me, I was like, I don't know, mate. I was having a life.
Yeah, exactly. It's really not worth getting engaged. It's not, but just leave it alone if you can. But I've realized that I can't. It's almost like an addiction. I have a compulsion. Do you know what, as well? I've been so much more productive not being on Twitter. It's unbelievable how much time it's freed up.
What about Titania McGrath?
Well, I mean, I can give you the backstory to that. I mean, I started her in early 2018. I wrote a book as her called Woke, A Guide to Social Justice, which came out in March 2019, exactly 5 years ago, actually. Mm-hmm. And there was some really good investigative journalism in The Times by a writer called Rosalind Irwin, who found out that it was me somehow. I mean, was contacting friends of mine, doing like comparing quotations from the book to things that I've written in my Spiked articles. I mean, really good work.
Good on them.
Really good work, yeah. And then, so I was outed as Tatiana McGrath. A lot of people thought it was deliberate because it coincided with the week of the book's release and suddenly it sold really well. It wasn't calculated at all because then there were lots of stories about how it was me. Anyway, that's a side point. And then I kept tweeting as a character and I was doing it for a number of years. I did one today, but I only tweet very rarely now. And I think it's because I feel like I've done that. I wrote two books as Titania. I wrote a national tour, which didn't go ahead because of the pandemic, but at least we got to do a show in the West End of London, which was great. We got to do a run at the Edinburgh Fringe, which was great. It may be that I do something else with her, modify her in some other way and do something more. At the moment, though, on Twitter, I also just tweet something and leave it. I write a column as her every month for The Critic magazine. So I'm still ticking over, but I've got we got so much more stuff to get on with. I mean, so I haven't really got time is the truth of it.
Yeah. Well, that's good. You're keeping busy. And where can we send people to look at your stuff?
The best thing is to look at my Substack. And that's, what is it? AndrewDoyle.substack.com, I imagine.
Yes. we'll put a link in the description
Great. And in that I'm regularly posting thoughts and articles, and I've got a weekly podcast for paid subscribers, which is just me reflecting on various things, and that's kind of fun to do. I really enjoy that, actually, even though I know not many people are listening. That's just really for me and for them. And then I'm also on Twitter at AndrewDoyle_com, but you'll just find me posting back to my Substack. So you may as well just go to the Substack. Also, I have a show every week on GB News called Free Speech Nation, which is on Sundays at 7 o'clock on GB News. I'm also a host of Headliners, which is the late night paper preview show every night, 11 o'clock, 7 days a week. It's three comedians talking about what's in the next day's papers. And I'm the executive producer of that show as well.
Brilliant. I was on Free Speech Nation. That was good.
You were?
I was very nervous. It was one of my first times in front of a camera in that sense. And
did I make you nervous? I hope not.
No, but I said to you, I'm really nervous. And you said, you'll be fine. And I felt good then.
And it was all right.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that back in the day when we didn't have an audience?
No, there was an audience.
There was an audience, yeah.
Yeah, which is what made me nervous. I hadn't been in front of, I'd been so used to my computer little geeky thing.
Yeah.
And now there's actual real people in front of me. I was like, oh, hello.
No, it's kind of fun because it's the only show on GB News that has an audience. Apart from those, the ones where Nigel Farage goes out and has an audience around the country. But apart from that, it's the show in the studio with an audience. And it means that we get questions from the audience. We just talk with them. It's a bit more lively, I'd say.
Who's a heretic you admire?
Oh, now you did suggest I should prepare something.
Nobody ever does. Well, I mean, we can do a gap if you have to think.
No, I mean, there's a lot that I can choose from. Mostly the heretics that I admire the most are the artistic ones, the ones who have taken artistic risks. And that has paid off. So let's consider novelists. I would say Stella Benson is a good example of a heretic who I admire. Stella Benson was a suffragette. She was a brilliant novelist, one of the best, one of my favorites. I have this thing where whenever I read a work of fiction, I underline, a lot of people do this, but I just underline passages that I think are particularly powerful. And I gave up with Stella Benson because you're doing it every page all the time. So there's no point. Some of her books are more difficult than others. The ones I'd recommend are her first book, actually, which is a book called I Pose, is really fantastic. It's about a suffragette meeting a gardener on a road and they end up going to the West Indies together. I won't say any more than that. Very odd. She's very unusual. She often comments on her own status as a novelist in the novel. There's one novel she wrote called Pipers and a Dancer where her lead character is reading a Stella Benson book. Mm. And bear in mind, this is like in the 1910s. That's an odd thing to, after Joyce, that sort of thing happened a lot, you know, but in these early days, it wasn't quite so common. She's
Gertrude Stein kind of thing.
Yeah, she's an incredible, I think, heretic just insofar as she was thinking outside the box, not just in terms of women's rights, but I think also in terms of what you can do with fiction, how you can write. She has some great travel narratives as well, which are really, really good. The other novelists I really love are Norman Douglas is a fantastic novelist, total heretic, also repugnant morally. So I think that's a really interesting test of whether we can separate the art from the artist.
Okay. Roland Barthes, The Death of the Author.
Yes, well, he thought the artist wasn't even relevant. He thought it doesn't matter at all. I tend towards that view, actually. I don't think much of what Roland Barthes says aligns with what I say. I think it's far too cynical, like a lover's discourse and all the rest of it. I think it's far too cynical. And I think there is something innate in us that extends beyond language and the language with which we can express it. But certainly when it comes to, I mean, if I were to eradicate from my book collection everything from a writer who had moral issues, there would be basically nothing left. And you'd have to scrap all of the kind of the classics. You'd have to scrap Ovid. You'd have to scrap Horace.
Michael
Jackson, if you believe the allegations, you'd have to scrap that as well.
Yeah. You know who's got the best quote on that? Robbie Williams. And he said after performing in Qatar and Israel and Saudi Arabia and everywhere, and everyone was angry at him. And he said, if I had to worry about human rights abuses, I wouldn't be able to perform in my own kitchen.
Yeah.
I love that.
So look, one more. Should I give you one more?
Go on. You love that. You're in your element talking about the literature and the arts. That's what you wish you were doing.
Well, yeah. Well, of course, that's what I wish I was doing.
What you are doing.
That's what I'm doing right now. The last heretic, I would say, is a novelist called Forrest Reid, who was born in Belfast in the 1870s. Mm. And, you know, recognized as one of the best novelists of the time, totally forgotten now, every book out of print. And at the time, people like Ian Forster were saying, look, come over to the UK and we'll get in with literary circles and we'll make you big and all the rest of it. And he wasn't interested. And he only wrote about one thing, which is his experience as being an adolescent male in Belfast in the 1870s. Every book is about that. It's like he's just perfecting this one vision. He had complete arrested development, right?
Wow.
When he turned 16, he tried to kill himself with laudanum because he could not bear to be an adult. And he said, even into his adult life, he was stuck at the age of 16. And so he writes, when I read his work, I remember how I used to see the world as a 15-year-old through the way he writes. But he writes with the power of an adult who can write beautiful prose.
Interesting.
So you don't get that with the way a 15-year-old writes. It doesn't have that effect.
J.D. Salinger, is it kind of
Catcher in the Rye? No, I mean, I don't think they're comparable. I actually didn't really like Catcher in the Rye. Reid is a pagan. He's obsessed with pagan. At a time, Belfast in the 1870s was not a good time to be a pagan. Mm. And the best thing to read by him is a book called his autobiography, which is called Apostate, which pretty much sums up what you're asking for in terms of heresy. He talks about when he was 5 being taken to church and screaming and throwing the Bibles and the missals down onto the floor and screaming like he had an innate aversion to what he calls the death cult of Christianity, which is utterly bizarre. He worshipped Socrates and the ancient Greeks. He had a belief in animism. Now, that to me is a kind of genius, because genius is something that is unprecedented, that doesn't come in the culture around you. How could a boy in a Presbyterian family at this time in Belfast have those affiliations for the values of ancient Greece? It doesn't make any sense. He hadn't read anything of it. It was innate. And it comes through his writing. And he's also, one of the best prose stylists of the early 20th century. But no one's ever heard of him. So I would say read Apostate, because also there is something so fascinating about what Belfast was, the pre-industrialized Belfast, just before that time when you got the mills and the cars and the technology. There's something so fascinating about that book and about his capacity to put you into the mindset of a child and an adolescent from a completely different era. It is fascinating, bizarre. He's also gay, of course. Mm. And so therefore, he's writing, bear in mind, Apostate was written in the 1920s. And there's this moment towards the end of the book where he's talking about this boy, this fellow apprentice at the factory he's working at, and he's obsessed with him, deeply in love with him. And there's a wonderful moment where he shows him his diary and he watches him turning the pages. And the book ends and we don't get the reaction because in the diary, he's saying that he's in love with him. What's amazing about this is that for a start, that this was published in 1926 and no one said, you're just outing yourself here. This is crazy. Yeah. I mean, it's not explicit, obviously, but it's so clear what's going on. So to me, all of that is absolutely fascinating and definitely a form of heresy.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. He's not better known with the nominative determinism of Reid.
Yeah. You would think. I mean, actually,
maybe that's why.
Forrest Reid as a name.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like an animistic name.
Or an imperative to Mr. Gump. Forrest Reid, you know.
I mean, yeah. That shouldn't make someone famous though, should it?
It shouldn't, but I like that, you know, I should have gone into jewellery or whatever. I like all that. I'm always out for a nominative determinism. It's fascinating and I'm glad we got to talk about that and I got to listen about that on a podcast because we don't, you know, we're just so culture war heavy. So thank you for that.
Okay, no worries.
Thank you, Andrew Doyle, who is fast becoming a good friend of mine. And what a pleasure it was to speak to him. To hear someone speak with such passion about such an important topic is a rarity, I think. I think there are a lot of people, there are a lot of speakers, we all talk and blah, blah, blah. But Andrew, you can feel the passion and how closely he feels linked to many of these topics. So thank you, Andrew Doyle. Please do go look up his books, Free Speech and The New Puritans, and find his Substack. Otherwise, yeah, send this episode out into the world. If you've got friends you think need to listen to this, if you've got people you think don't need to but want to listen to it, get it out there. That's the way that this podcast grows. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team, led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.